by Egyptian authorities to imprison people without ever having to put them on trial. So again, you know, these arrests are a huge blow to civil society in Egypt, and not just to civil society, to independent media, to grassroots activism and movements. And it has really sent shockwaves throughout the community here.
I know that Massachusetts Senator Elizabeth Warren has condemned the arrest. What about the ambassadors who attended the meeting, other countries, and very quickly, what your hopes are for next steps?
Well, the response has frankly been quite tepid from the European countries that attended this meeting, and the arrests were in response to. I was expecting to see more. I believe Norway has put out a statement. In the U.S., Senator Chris Coons, who's being talked about as possibly as possible appointee as Secretary of State under Biden, also tweeted against this. And then the Human Rights Council today condemned the arrests, saying they're part of a broader pattern of intimidating organizations working on human rights in Egypt and using counterterrorism and national security legislation to silence dissent. The French Foreign Ministry also put out a statement condemning the arrests, but Egypt's Foreign Ministry very quickly then rejected their statement and saying it's an interference in Egypt's internal affairs. So we'll have to see what happens.
Sharif, thanks so much for being with us. Sharif Abdelkadous, Democracy Now! Correspondent and a reporter from Adamasser, based in Cairo. Please be safe. And that does it for our broadcast. A happy birthday and a fond farewell. And all the very best to our digital intern, Noah Flora. That does it for the show. Democracy Now! Is produced with Mike Burke, Renee Feltz, Dina Guzder, Libby Rainey, Nermeen Sheikh, Maria Tarasena, Carla Wills, Tammy Warrenoff, Tarina Nadura, Sam Alkoff, Tamari A. Studio, John Hamilton, Robbie Karen, Honey Masood, Adriana Contreras. Our general manager is Julie Crosby. Our director is Becca Staley. Thanks to Miriam Barnard, Paul Powell, Mike DeFilippo, Miguel Nogueira, Hugh Grant, Dennis Moynihan, David Prude, and Dennis McCormick. Please be safe. Wear a mask. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for joining us.
You are tuned to listener-supported community radio, KBOO Portland.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO Community Radio's open meeting policy is available at our website at kboo.fm. Due to the temporary closure of in-station activity at KBOO, meetings will be conducted online via public video conferencing unless otherwise noted. A public link and phone number to attend the meetings are available on our website. The Development and Events Committee meets on the fourth Monday of the month at 4:30 p.m. Please visit our website at kboo.fm to verify if a meeting is being held.
Are you still looking for a way to fit KBOO into your year-end giving? KBOO is in this year's Willamette Week Give Guide. For the last 14 years, Give Guide has raised over $28 million for hundreds of local nonprofits. Support KBOO and learn more about Give Guide by going to kboo.fm/give. Remember, we have a one-to-one match for all new and increasing donations, too. Thank you for supporting KBOO.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, the city of Portland is attempting to bypass the police union's objection to civilian oversight. Oregon set a record for COVID-19 deaths as legislators call for increased testing, and 70,000 Oregonians are at risk of losing their unemployment benefits the day after Christmas. Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Friday, November 20th, 2020. I'm Nat Moon. More than 80% of Portland voters favored the measure to create an independent police oversight board. Despite that overwhelming show of citizen support, 2 days after the election, the Portland Police Association filed a grievance with the city, claiming that it would violate their union contract. In their grievance, the union cited court rulings in 2010 and 2016 by the Employment Relations Board that rejected attempts by the city to allegedly evade bargaining obligations with the police union. In a press release, the PPA said, quote, "Under Oregon law, the very existence of a disciplinary board must be negotiated with the PPA before being sent to the voters." But this time, rather than take the PPA head on, the city has asked State Senator Lou Frederick to introduce a bill that would initiate a statewide change, allowing Portland to move ahead with the oversight board. The proposed bill would allow the creation of a citizen review board to overview law enforcement discipline without the restrictions imposed by collective bargaining rules for public employees. Brian Hunziker, the new head of the PPA, bemoaned the city's effort to circumvent the rules, saying, quote, "This is somebody didn't get their way, so they're going to force everybody else to change the rules to get their way." Senator Frederick said that there could be a long way to go before a vote on the bill, but the overwhelming public support suggests that it will pass when the vote finally comes up in the legislature. Portland Mayor Ted Wheeler, who is also the police commissioner, has said that the city would make every effort to move forward with the Citizen Review Board, but his office did not comment on the proposed bill. The contract with the police union was originally set to expire earlier this year, but talks were postponed until January of 2021 due to the pandemic. In downtown Portland yesterday afternoon, a small but vocal group of demonstrators gathered outside the Multnomah County Justice Center to voice their opposition to recent Black Lives Matter protests. About 20 pro-police demonstrators participated in what they described as a, quote, "Back the Blue" rally. Some carried Trump 2020 flags. Across the street, an equal number of counter-protesters voiced their opposition. Some of the Back the Blue demonstrators were visibly armed with firearms, clubs, and baseball bats, and there were reports that some of the counter-protesters carried guns and pepper spray. The two groups insulted and taunted each other throughout the afternoon, while Portland police kept them separated and checked the gun permits of the armed protesters on both sides. One Back the Blue protester was arrested for having a loaded rifle. Another was heard shouting racial slurs. Even though the presidential election was called for Joe Biden nearly 2 weeks ago, tensions remain high as Trump supporters refuse to accept his defeat and as the president continues to trumpet his repeated and unfounded claims of voter fraud. Trump supporters are planning to hold a second Defeat the Steal rally in Salem this weekend. The day after Governor Kate Brown's statewide freeze went into effect, Oregon reported a record increase in both coronavirus cases and deaths related to COVID-19. Yesterday, the Oregon Health Authority reported 1,225 new cases and 20 more deaths, bringing the state's death toll to more than 800. And while many of the deaths were among senior citizens, the virus also took a 30-year-old Lane County man, a 40-year-old Mallard County man, and a 49-year-old Jackson County man. In a response to virus skeptics, OHA Director Patrick Allen said, quote, "I have heard frequently from those who have refused to believe this pandemic is serious if we aren't seeing hospitalizations and deaths. Those hospitalizations and deaths are here and are only likely to go up." With the rising case and death counts, more than 30 Oregon lawmakers wrote a letter to Governor Brown requesting a dramatic increase in coronavirus testing in the state. The November 16th letter said, quote, "At the forefront of the problem, the lack of available, easily accessible testing remains a concern that must be addressed immediately." The letter was signed by state representatives and senators, including some Republicans. According to one source, Oregon ranks 49th in the state and falls significantly behind Washington, despite having a higher positivity rate. OHA officials have said that the testing limitation is not caused by a shortage of test supplies, but by a shortage of skilled medical workers to administer the tests. Healthcare officials are speaking out against statements a Clackamas County politician made earlier this week rejecting Governor Kate Brown's freeze orders for Thanksgiving. Tootie Smith, chair-elect for the Clackamas County Commission, gained national attention after posting her plans for a Thanksgiving with, quote, as many friends and family as I can find. During an appearance on Fox News, Smith said, "We do not need to be treated as second-rate slaves in our own homes," referring to Brown's urging to forego large holiday get-togethers. Dr. Paul Lewis, the former health officer for Clackamas County, called Smith's message irresponsible and dangerous. Lewis, along with many other health authorities, expressed major concerns with people socializing in large indoor groups over the traditional family holiday, fearing that asymptomatic carriers of COVID-19 could spread the disease to multiple people and households. Oregon epidemiologist Dr. Sean Seidlinger said on Friday, quote, "This is likely the most dangerous time for COVID infections in Oregon. We can't pretend the virus is going away on its own." And it's not just health professionals who are angered by Smith's comments. Peter Lund, an Oregon City business owner, released a video on social media chiding Smith, saying it's already time for the incoming commissioner to go. In an op-ed for the Portland Tribune, Lund urged Clackamas County residents to start collecting signatures to recall Smith. Citing the damaging nature of her remarks, Lund said, quote, "Pretty obvious that Smith does not deserve to be in leadership." Higher education in Oregon has not recovered from the budget cuts of the financial crisis, and lawmakers are being urged to avoid further cuts during the pandemic. For more on the story, here's Eric Tegedoff of the Oregon News Service.
State lawmakers should avoid making drastic cuts to higher education, a new report urges. An analysis from Lumina Foundation and the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation acknowledges slashing funds likely will be necessary because of the economic fallout from the pandemic. But it says across-the-board cuts would affect Black, Hispanic, Native American, and low-income students the most. In line with the report, Ben Cannon, who heads the Oregon Higher Education Coordinating Commission, says the state needs to preserve financial aid.
We are already a below average state in terms of investment in need-based financial aid. And I think ensuring that we continue to support our state's highest need students and ideally increase state aid to our highest need students is really important.
Cannon says Oregon has accrued a substantial rainy day fund since the Great Recession and should consider using it to stabilize post-secondary education and other budget items in 2021. Gabriela Gomez with the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation says it may seem fair to make blanket cuts to higher education, but it actually hits the most vulnerable students hardest.
These cuts where you slash and burn across the board just don't work. And actually what ends up happening is there's tremendous rollback.
The report also suggests institutions consider the large cost to deliver education and that policymakers support programs and strategies that advance students' ability to complete credentials that will allow them to get good jobs. Cannon says Oregon made cuts to higher ed a decade ago in the recession, and the effect was tuition and cost increases. He says it's a burden low- and middle-income students can't bear in this downturn.
Our commission absolutely supports a level of state investment that would minimize tuition increases, minimize that cost shift to students, and in doing so, help prepare Oregonians to contribute to an economic recovery.
Support for this reporting was provided by Lumina Foundation. For Oregon News Service, I'm Eric Tegedoff.
The latest Labor Department figures show that jobless claims in the U.S. rose to 742,000 last week, up from 711,000 the week before. Yet despite these grim numbers, two key federal programs are set to expire, and thousands of Oregonians could lose benefits the day after Christmas. The Pandemic Unemployment Assistance Program and the Pandemic Unemployment Emergency Compensation Program are set to expire on December 26th. The PUA program provides unemployment benefits to gig workers and the self-employed. These workers previously had no coverage. And the PUEC program provides an extra 13 weeks of benefits to individuals who've used up their state benefits. But with the programs set to expire, more than 70,000 Oregonians and 12 million Americans are set to lose their benefits as we head into winter during the worst pandemic in over 100 years. And according to the Oregon Employment Department, most of those losing their extended benefits won't have other options. In a statement, Acting OED Director David Gerstenfeld said, quote, "For PUEC, some of those people may be able to get extended benefits for a period of time. But unfortunately, a lot of those people won't have any safety net left that we're able to provide." With Congress in gridlock over additional pandemic aid to the unemployed, many are worried about paying for basic necessities like food and rent. And even if Congress were to act immediately to keep the PUA and PUEC programs going, Oregon employment officials say that they will be tough to implement without some kind of break in coverage. A group of Northwest immigration attorneys have filed a class action lawsuit against a federal agency that rejected thousands of humanitarian visas last year. The lawsuit challenges that new agency policies implemented by the U.S. Citizenship and Immigration Services were denying visa applications for asylum seekers as well as victims escaping dangerous living conditions, including human trafficking and political violence. The new policy allowed denial of applications if any fields were left blank or if questions were unanswered, regardless of whether or not those fields were pertinent to the applicant's individual situation. Matt Adams, legal director of the Northwest Immigrant Rights Project and one of the attorneys pushing the lawsuit, said, quote, "If someone doesn't put something down in the blank for their middle name because they don't have a middle name, it gets rejected. It's like some bureaucratic, diabolical scheme. For decades, the USCIS had accepted applications with blank fields. As long as those fields were not relevant to the applicant or were not critical to eligibility for the requested benefit. Humanitarian visas are long-standing protections provided for immigrants fleeing hostile, often violent, situations in their home countries. Attorneys claim the government did not give any notice to the new policy, which began late last year. Adams said as of July 2020, nearly 12,000 applications from crime victims alone were rejected. A spokesperson from the USCIS said the agency does not comment on pending litigations. You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. Coming up next at 5:30, it's Counterspin. At 6, it's Rising Up with Sana Lee. Then at 7, The Struggle with Alyssa Pariah. Tonight, we can expect a clear sky with overnight lows just above freezing. Tomorrow, we can look forward to a mostly cloudy day with little chance of precipitation and a daytime high of about 50. On this day in 1866, the Howard Normal and Theological School for the Education of Teachers and Preachers was founded in Washington, D.C. Today, the school is known as Howard University, and it's one of over 100 historically black colleges and universities in the United States. Today's quote is from Howard graduate Chadwick Boseman's commencement speech in 2018. Boseman said, quote, "Howard's legacy is not wrapped up in the money that you'll make, but in the challenges that you choose to confront. As you honor your past, press on with purpose." Kyle Rittenhouse was released from a Kenosha, Wisconsin jail earlier today after lawyers posted his $2 million bail. The 17-year-old is accused of shooting three men during a summer protest in Kenosha. Two of the victims died and the third was shot in the arm. The demonstrations followed white police officer Rustin Chesky's shooting of Jacob Blake, a black man, days earlier. Rittenhouse's bail was apparently funded by donations from right-wing supporters, where Rittenhouse has gained much popularity. In Wisconsin, defendants must pay the full sum of the bail up front. Rittenhouse's attorneys, John N. Pierce and L. Lynn Wood, have claimed that the young man was acting in self-defense, despite the fact that videos of the scene appear to show him firing on unarmed protesters without provocation. The attorneys used their own Twitter accounts to call for donations for Rittenhouse's bail, while also touting other conservative messages, including the false claim that President Donald Trump won re-election. On Friday, Wood tweeted, quote, "President Trump will never concede to Joey, in quotes, bribes Biden." He's also filed a lawsuit in his home state of Georgia to prevent certification of the 2020 election results. Trump remains focused on fighting his defeat as the COVID-19 pandemic rages to record levels every day. With more on that story and others, it's Lily Bolke with 2020 Talks.
Welcome to 2020 Talks, where we track the 2020 elections in uncharted territory.
Incredibly damaging messages being sent to the rest of the world about how democracy functions.
President-elect Joe Biden warned yesterday that waiting much longer to begin the official transition is going to have wide-reaching implications, from issues of national security to a vaccine distribution plan. As President Donald Trump continues disputing the election results, Biden called him among, quote, the most irresponsible presidents in history.
And I think most of the Republicans I've spoken to, including some of the governors, think this is debilitating. It sends a horrible message about who we are as a country.
Certification deadlines in crucial battleground states are looming. After completing the recount and reaffirming Biden's win, Georgia's results become official today, followed by Pennsylvania and Michigan on Monday. David Levine with the Alliance for Securing Democracy hopes that once Wisconsin's partial recount and other states' audits are complete, the partisan battle over the results will die down.
I'm hopeful that as more states certify results, right, conduct audits of the elections, so we go further on through the process, that there can be more people, even if their preferred candidates didn't win, they will understand that, in fact, the outcome was legitimate. The process was legitimate.
News came out that Trump called and thanked one of the Wayne County Republican officials who attempted, without success, to rescind her vote to certify results in Detroit. Trump invited GOP leader of the Michigan Senate, Mike Shirkey, for a meeting at the White House today. Some conservative groups in Michigan have reportedly begun urging lawmakers to overturn the results and send a slate of electors in favor of Trump to the Electoral College next month. Earlier this week, Shirkey said, quote, "That's not going to happen." Governor Gretchen Whitmer, a Democrat, pointed out that Biden's margin in Michigan was 14 times Trump's margin in 2016.
Stop spending energy to mislead about what happened in this election and spend it on a real COVID relief package. That's what the people of our country need more than ever. This election was overwhelmingly decided. It was a safe, it was a secure, it was a fair election.
And progressive Democrats held a rally with masks and social distancing outside the Democratic National Committee headquarters, urging the Biden administration to keep its promises on climate change, racial justice, and other key issues. Here's Jamal Bowman, incoming representative in New York.
Black and brown communities organized across the country to make sure Joe Biden won the White House. And he did that. But now it's time for payback. And now it's time to make sure that we invest the resources necessary to rebuild our nation in a way that is representative of all of us, so we can truly have the people's house.
The two Georgia runoff elections that will determine which party controls the Senate are drawing huge financial attention from across the country. $125 million have flowed into the state. From Pacifica Network and Public News Service, and produced for television by Free Speech TV, I'm Lily Bolke. Thanks for listening.
Officials from the U.S. Census Bureau are saying they won't have the data on time to meet the Trump administration's deadline for population count. This comes as a blow to the current administration, who had hoped to strip unauthorized immigrants from census totals used for reapportionment. Accurate state population totals are required to reallocate seats in the House of Representatives, where Democrats still hold a narrow majority following elections earlier this month. This week, Census Bureau officials concluded that they will not be able to produce these totals until after President Trump leaves office in January. In July, the administration announced a plan to shift the House majority by removing unauthorized immigrants from the census count for the first time in history. Doing this would have left an older, white demographic in control of House seats. But citing the challenges of the ongoing coronavirus pandemic, the Census Bureau asked for more time to complete the count. That appeal was turned down by the president, who ordered that the statutory December 31st deadline be met. That order would have required the Census Bureau to process over 5 months of data in just 2.5 months. On Wednesday, anonymous census officials announced that due to glitches in the massive data processing operation, the completion of population calculations would not be available before January 26th, and likely not until early February. The Commerce Department, which oversees the Census Bureau, did not add comment following the news of the delayed results, but Census Bureau Director Stephen Dillingham publicly acknowledged the delay. Dillingham told the New York Times, quote, "Processing anomalies have occurred in past censuses. I am directing the Census Bureau to utilize all resources available to resolve this as expeditiously as possible. Our goal remains an accurate and statistically sound census." The Supreme Court is set this month to consider claims that Trump's order violates the Constitution's mandate that, quote, "the whole number of persons in each state be used to allocate House seats." Dale Ho, director of the ACLU's Voting Rights Project, argued this case in front of a 3-judge panel in New York earlier in September and won a unanimous ruling that Trump's order exceeded his authority under federal laws governing the census and reapportionment. Courts in California and Maryland have also ruled that it is unconstitutional to remove undocumented immigrants from the apportionment count. A bill to expand broadband access to Native Americans is working its way through Congress. With that story and more, it's Megan Kamrick with National Native News, the daily newscast dedicated to Indigenous news, issues, and culture.
This is National Native News. I'm Megan Kamrick in for Antonia Gonzalez. A bill that would help Native American communities get more broadband access on reservation lands passed to the U.S. Senate Indian Affairs Committee Wednesday. Steve Jackson reports from Spokane.
An FCC survey found that 31% of households on tribal lands lack access to high-speed broadband, compared to 7% of Americans in non-tribal areas. At a hearing Wednesday, Senator Maria Cantwell spoke about the impact that some Washington tribes have experienced because of the lack of service.
For the Colville tribe in north central Washington, many of the households don't have access to the internet. This means many of the households don't have access to emergency service notifications. Connectivity is critically important during fire season, especially this year as fires have forced evacuations from homes and businesses. It's absolutely unacceptable for these tribes and many others living on tribal lands throughout the state of Washington to not have access to basic, reliable broadband.
Cantwell co-sponsored the legislation, which would require technical assistance be provided to the underserved Native communities and set aside FCC and USDA funding for broadband deployment. The bill passed on a bipartisan voice vote Wednesday and now heads to the full Senate for consideration. For National Native News, I'm Steve Jackson reporting from Spokane.
A group made up of 5 First Nations in Canada says it plans to invest up to $765 million in the Keystone XL pipeline. Bloomberg reports TC Energy Corporation is counting on the deal with Natural Law Energy to save the controversial pipeline from the incoming administration of President-elect Joe Biden. The pipeline must have a permit from the U.S. government since it crosses the border with Canada. The Trump administration granted the permit, but Biden's campaign has said it plans to rescind it. Reuters reports the agreement includes the Nikanit and Little Pine First Nations in Saskatchewan and the Ermineskin Cree Nation, Montana First Nation, and Lewis Bull Tribe in Alberta. Chief Alvin Francis, president of Natural Law Energy and chief of Nicanete First Nation, said in a news release the deal is a historic one that will create intergenerational wealth. He also pledged that Natural Law and TC Energy will ensure the pipeline is, quote, held to the highest levels of environmental and social responsibility. Natural Law Energy has until next September to secure financing for the deal. In Minnesota, two people on Wednesday locked themselves to equipment used on Line 3 of the Enbridge Sands oil pipeline to protest permits granted for the project by the state. Native News Online reports the action was organized by the Ginnu Collective. Minnesota Public Radio reports that approval of a key water permit for the project prompted 12 members of an advisory group to the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency to resign. That included White Earth Tribal member Winona LaDuke. Enbridge's Line 3 would transport up to 760,000 barrels of crude oil daily through northern Minnesota. The project is opposed by five Ojibwe bands. If you look at a map of how Arizonans voted in this election, you'll see several blue blocks that don't correspond with urban areas. Emma Gibson with Arizona Public Media reports most of these rural precincts are from voters living in tribal lands.
High Country News reports that 60 to 90% of votes in precincts across the Navajo Nation went to Biden and Vice President-elect Kamala Harris. Ali Young is the founder of Protect the Sacred, a grassroots initiative responding to the pandemic and promoting voter education within the Navajo Nation.
I'm very proud, especially of our tribal communities in Arizona, for showing the world that Arizona is indigenous DNA, that we reclaimed Arizona.
A map created by ABC 15 Arizona shows that on average, almost 94% of votes in the Thana-A'atham Nation went blue too. For National Native News, I'm Emma Gibson.
And I'm Megan Kamrick.
Claiming voter fraud, the Trump campaign is paying a $3 million fee to have the votes recounted in Milwaukee County. For more on that, here's Mike Moen with the Public News Service.
A partial recount of Wisconsin votes in the presidential race begins today. It comes amid repeated election fraud claims from President Donald Trump, despite those claims going unfounded. The Milwaukee Voter Outreach Group views the request as an attack on black voters. President Trump requested a ballot recount in Milwaukee and Dane counties, both of which are considered more liberal. Milwaukee County also is home to the state's largest number of black residents at nearly 27%. Greg Lewis of the group Souls to the Polls says after all the outreach work that was done in the middle of a pandemic, it's difficult to see a recount with such a narrow focus.
It's very disrespectful for someone to come along and really cast a shadow and cast doubt